Let me say that it is an honor again to be with President Clinton and Vice President Gore. I had the honor with Senator Reid of being with them in February, and I was looking forward to being with them to talk about energy again in August. I didn't realize I was going to get a little jump on that in an airplane hangar in Burbank last week, but I appreciate the opportunity to be with them. I guess I would have to note that that's the most energy-efficient airplane hangar in the world, so that's a good thing, too. I think this morning was great. We really drilled down on a number of topics, and hopefully we're going to go even deeper with your questions and comments. And I think Tim did a great job of really summarizing and writing a book for us at the end of that session this morning. I want to get right to the questions, so I'm not going to give long introductions. In fact, I'm not going to even give introductions to Vice President Gore, to Senator Reid, and to Boone Pickens. You've heard them this morning. You know them well. I do want to say a word about Kathy Zoi, who's a great leader on energy and has been a colleague of mine for many years. She is now serves as the Assistant Secretary for Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy at the Department of Energy. She manages a program that invests $16 billion in research, development, and deployment of renewable energy and energy efficiency technology. And she was previously the founding Chief Executive Officer of the Alliance for Climate Protection, which Vice President Gore chairs. She served in the Clinton-Gore administration with me in the White House, and before that at EPA. And I just have to make one personal note, which is she served on a international panel that the Center for American Progress convened, that Tim Wirth served on, that issued a report about 4 years ago that called on the world to set a 2 degree C standard globally as a mark to which that the world needed to orient its policy towards, and that was just adopted at the G8 meeting this summer. So Kathy, the only thing I have to say is Kathy was representing Australia at the time, so she's a woman of many facets, and we're glad to have her here today. The way we're going to do this is we're going to go to some questions. I've got a monitor here. I'm going to read questions that have been submitted by text, and we're going to try to keep this going as a conversation, so I invite the panelists to jump in. Even if a question is directed to a single party, to just jump in and add your thoughts. I thought I might just take the opportunity as the moderator to ask Vice President Gore the first question, then we'll kick it off with the audience, which is Tim Wirth noted this morning that you're about to produce a book, or you've authored a new book, and it's about to come out on climate solutions. And I wanted to really just begin by asking you, what gives you confidence actually that we can solve this problem? What's exciting you about the solutions that you're seeing that the book which will come out in September is keeping you pumped up about?
Well, thank you very much, John, and congratulations again to you and your colleagues at the Center for American Progress on organizing, playing a key role in bringing this to pass for the second time. The book comes out actually November 3rd, 1 month before the Copenhagen meeting, and it will be published in a number of countries around the world. It's called Our Choice, A Plan to Solve the Climate Crisis. And it's taken me 3 years to write it. I mentioned that for the last 2 years I've had 32 solution summits delving deeply into the technologies, the economics, the politics, et cetera, et cetera. And what gives me optimism is that we really do have all the tools that we need. It's true that some of the emerging technologies in the field of renewable energy, for example, are constantly getting better. And the speed with which they're getting better is very, very encouraging. There is a widespread recognition around the world that we face this unprecedented challenge. If we decide to solve it, as I hope and expect we will, we can solve it. But I don't want to be Pollyannish about this. We're now at a moment of choosing, and in my faith tradition, and I'm not proselytizing here for people of other faiths or people who are atheists or whatever, but my values are in significant measure rooted in the faith tradition that I come out of, and there is a well-known saying that is in the Christian Bible, it's in the Torah, it's in the Quran, and God is speaking in this quotation and says, I offer you a choice, life or death. You must choose either blessings or curses. And the choice that we face now is really and truly that choice, in my opinion, because if we continue on the road we're now traveling, the global warming pollution will accumulate to the point where we're in real danger of it spinning out of control and becoming a very different planet from the one on which human life emerged, much less the one on which human civilization developed. If we take the other path soon, we have an opportunity not only to avoid that catastrophe, but to solve many problems that have been lingering for far too long. All the children that die unnecessarily every day, the abject poverty, extreme poverty and diseases, the loss of soil fertility in Africa. There are multiple challenges that really all hinge on us getting our act together. So this book looks at, in depth, all of the new renewable energy technologies, all of the efficiency topics that we discussed this morning. It also looks at the neuroscience and behavioral psychology of why it is we have been slow to come to grips with this. In a nutshell, we are sort of hardwired to respond with urgency to the kinds of threats that our ancestors survived. And when a much more serious threat than a leopard or a snake arrives, and we can only perceive it by using our reasoning capacity and seeing a pattern on a global scale and coming to grips with the shocking fact that the whole relationship between humankind and this planet has been fundamentally altered, and we now have to take responsibility for our actions, we've got to penetrate through that. Politics plays a role. You know, these people who put a little poison into the political bloodstream by yelling that President Obama's not an American citizen, and they show the birth certificate, the contemporary newspaper announcements in both of the Honolulu papers, they're not persuaded. That's very similar in some ways to the refusal of some people to actually accept what the scientific community worldwide is telling us. Pat Moynihan, with whom Harry and I had the privilege of serving, said a lot of great things, but one saying for which he's remembered, he says, everybody's entitled to his own opinion, but not everybody's entitled to his own facts. And the means by which a free, self-governing people arrive at a sufficient agreement on what's most likely to be true, seek out the best evidence, discuss it in good faith, open to arguments, and then get to a point where we say, okay, you know, the earth is round, gravity does exist, et cetera, et cetera. Then we can disagree about what the proper response is. But there are too many who have looked over the horizon at what the responses might be. And if it challenges an incumbent industry, or if it has this implication or that, then their reaction is to hold the facts at arm's length and refuse to acknowledge the facts. We have to come to an agreement here in our country that facts are facts, and this scientific evidence is what it is. But I'm optimistic because so many people have begun to recognize it, to get engaged, and to get energized. And actually, what Senator Reid has done with this forum, this series of forums, is one of the best examples that I can think of why we ought to be optimistic about it. But we've got a lot of hard work to do. We are not there yet. And the key challenge is going to be this fall in the United States Senate in passing legislation like that proposed by President Obama and passed by the House of Representatives. And everybody here can make a difference in that. Special interests have powerful voices, but the people have the most powerful voice. If you decide to get involved, get engaged, and fight for our future, that's really the challenge. As I've said before, we've got everything we need with the possible exception of political will, but we know in the United States that political will really is a renewable resource.
John, I know that there are lots of people that have questions out there, but I have a question. And I direct it to any one of you four panelists. What happens, what would be your response if a senator came to you and said, that's great, but why should we do anything? India is not going to do anything. China is doing nothing. So why don't we just wait?
First of all, China and India are very different. China is the one other player that matters the most. India will be as large as China in the future, certainly in population, but in economic growth and global warming impact, they're a long way away from being a China. And China, as Secretary Chu said this morning, is moving very, very rapidly. You know, China, for each of the last few years, has planted 2.5 times more trees than the entire rest of the world put together. They're developing, as I mentioned in one of the earlier panels, or maybe at breakfast, the world's best unified national smart grid, 800 kilovolts, connecting the entire country, bringing wind from Xinjiang and bringing solar power from Xinjiang and wind and elsewhere. And they're really moving very rapidly. They have now informed a lot of their regional governors that to prepare for accepting CO2 reductions limits. And the so-called back-channel negotiations, which we're not supposed to talk about, have been discussed a little bit in the press, and it's fair to say that they have sent a very strong signal that if we pass legislation that accomplishes real reductions below the 1990 level by 2020, then they will feel obliged to be a part of this treaty. Whether that's bankable or not, the single best thing the United States of America can do to get China on board and eventually India as well is to take the lead and demonstrate that we strengthen our economy and create jobs and build the new base for high technology in the United States as a result of that commitment. If we wait until everybody says, okay, you go first, and then nobody goes first, we're the only nation that can really lead the world. And we should. It's time.
I have to say, I just have to add a word of my own, which is I think that what I would say, if you want to cede the industries of the future to the Chinese, then keep thinking that way. But if you want to create jobs, create innovation, create new businesses in the United States, then you got to have a new way of thinking. I mentioned that she was in Australia. You've seen Asia close up. Now you have this portfolio in the United States. Maybe you'd like to add a couple
of
comments.
Yeah, I would say there are folks in that chamber where you work, Senator Reid, that say this is a competitiveness issue. And it is. If we want to remain competitive and stay on top, we need a legal framework that creates incentives for clean energy. Because as Secretary Chu pointed out, those guys are moving. They're moving very, very fast. Some of the biggest solar manufacturer now is in China. In fact, I worked with the CEO of that company. He was a researcher at the University of New South Wales when I was in Australia. He moved back to his homeland in China, is now making more solar cells than anybody else around the world. They are moving, and as Secretary Chu points out, it is for their own domestic market. So this is a competitiveness issue, and if we want to retain our own competitiveness, we must have a binding clean energy framework in this country.
Could I comment?
Boone, please, join in.
I hear, I'm sure the rest of us have too, credibility of the United States has gone down over the years.
You got to use the mic.
Oh, sorry. That the credibility of the United States has gone down over from the past to where it is today. And I'm coming up on this from a different direction than I think you all are, but I'm told people are trying to do business with me that were from Ireland, and we're on wind, and we had a long meeting at the American Wind Conference in Chicago. And by the way, there were 24,000 registered people there. The year before it was 13,000, and 5 years before that, you could have put them in a closet. I mean, there was no interest in wind. It's gone up dramatically. I cannot believe the interest in wind. But anyway, at the conclusion of our meeting on wind, one of them said to me, he said, what are you trying to do on the Pickens plan? And I said, I'm trying to get off of foreign oil. And he said, well, why in the hell did you get on it in the first place? I said, good question, but my answer is a good answer too, is it was cheap. It was cheap. And so we used it, and we didn't, they said, but you're the only country in the world that is importing almost 70% of your oil. Well, the only one, he said. Now, he said, the rest of us same thing could have happened to us. We didn't do it because we had somebody that led us in the right direction and said, we can't get in this kind of a spot. So he said, your credibility is horrible because of your dependency on oil from really some of your enemy. And I said, well, without hurting my feelings, how do you summarize how America looks on this? And he said, I don't hardly know you, but he said, I think you can stand it, but he said, you look stupid. You look stupid. Okay, I think that if we got credibility back, the easiest way for us to get it, the fastest way to get it, is to get on our own resources here. And then you have a lot more influence on China or India or somebody else that look what they've done. They've gotten back on their own resources and they are leading in this direction. I don't think they're going to pay much attention to us until we solve some of our problems. But let me, the way I view it is that there's an energy table around the world. We're not sitting at that table. We're sitting over as consumer against the wall. It's the people that have the oil are the ones that are sitting at the table. They're deciding what's going to happen to us. And, you know, when I look back on it, that I can well remember, I think both administrations have been guilty of trying to go to the Saudis and say, give us more oil and bring the price down. I can remember very well Cheney going over, but did you all send anybody? You did or you didn't?
Did not.
You wouldn't go. Good for you, Al. But
I went, but I talked to he was then Crown Prince Abdullah about global warming and told him why it'd be in their best interest to help solve this.
Well, you go over and say turn your oil on. It's such a silly request to start with. That's the only resource those people have. Why are they going to sell it to us cheap? You know, you got to be kidding yourself. It doesn't even make sense. And you know, if you take that one step further, we're using 25% of all the oil every day in the world with 4% of the population. I know what's going to happen to us. That you're capped at 85 million is all the supply you're going to see in globally. That's all the globe can do. Fourth quarter of last year, it was projected that it was going to be 87 million barrels a day. That's a great part of why the price ran up. You were going to have a bigger demand than you had a supply. So, yes, the only way you can, with the supply capped, the only way you can get the demand down is with price. The price has to go up to kill the demand. And that's a big part of what we were looking at last year. Of course, then the economy and everything else went in the tank on us. And so it kind of masked what I was focused on was, wait a minute, you can't deliver the oil that is the demand is projecting. So, but here, maybe I took a long way around to this, and I'll summarize in 15 seconds, that if we could get our energy under control in this country, then we would be a lot better as a leader globally to show them how to do it from a green standpoint.
Well, I think Debbie from South Carolina probably didn't know she was asking a follow-up question, but she did. But by the question from Debbie in South Carolina was, what's being done on a national level for global warming? I think that's really a question directed to Senator Reid, which is what are the prospects that we're going to move forward with energy and comprehensive climate change legislation this year?
John, I would say to Debbie and all those within the sound of my voice, this has been a very productive Congress. We've only we're 25% of the way through this Congress, but all the pundits have said we've produced more legislation, meaningful legislation, except for the first 6 months of the Roosevelt administration. Having said that, even though it is very, very historic what we've done, until we do something about health care and something about energy, we are not going to be able to have the pats on the back that probably are necessary. There are some things that we've done regarding focusing on global warming. We've raised CAFE standards, but they're so minimal, and they're done in a scattershot way. We must do energy legislation as a package. We have to have a renewable portfolio standard. We have to do something that deals with appliances. We have to do something that deals with efficiency. We have to do something so that we, as Boone Pickens has lectured us many times, do something with our own energy, especially natural gas. We have to do something about producing batteries that's meaningful. And even though we don't have a lot to show for it at this time, we do have this massive bill that we passed, the third bill we passed this Congress, and that is the Economic Recovery Package, which has tens of billions of dollars only directed toward global warming and energy.
Our next question is from a resident of Las Vegas, Peter Harvey. What can we do to build some really large solar thermal plants in the El Dorado Valley? Maybe I'll throw that one to you, Kathy.
Well, at the Department of Energy, we're really excited about speed and scale. That's one of our planks. So I don't know what Peter means by really large, but the data suggests that you could take a parcel kind of 95 miles on a side in the southwest, right around here, and fill it up with solar panels, and it would be enough electricity to meet all of America's needs, theoretically. And we know, everybody can imagine the drive across the southwest and think, wow, that's a lot of 100-mile parcels that could be filled up with solar panels. So we have that within our grasp, but certainly possible. One of the things that we need to do, and I think our colleague from BrightSource, the solar thermal company, mentioned this morning, we've got to make it easier to get them sited. And I think Senator Reid has shown great leadership on the transmission issue. It turns out we've got the technology. Vice President Gore and I worked on an analysis last year, which basically said there are no material constraints to building thousands of gigawatts of solar thermal. There are no land constraints, as I've just mentioned, but there are institutional constraints. It turns out that this cracking climate change, bringing it under control, is really more of an organizational challenge for us than a technological one. So what we need to do, Peter, is we need to make it easier for business people to get access to capital and to get through the bureaucracy to connect to the grid to get that power to market.
Good. I totally agree. Wanted to add two brief points. If you really want to build those large solar plants in El Dorado Valley, need two things. Need to pass what Senator Reid was talking about a minute ago, a renewable portfolio standard, a national law that says utilities have to get a certain percent of their energy from renewable sources, and then you need to put a price on carbon. And the pending proposal to do that is to put a limit on the total amount of CO2 emissions and then allow the most efficient businesses that reduce their CO2, a lot of them will make money in the process, then they can trade their excess allowances to other businesses that are having a harder time at first, maybe inertia, maybe they haven't gotten around to it, but then that allows the economy to efficiently allocate resources to where it's going to get the biggest bang for the buck. But the problem is now, there's no price on CO2. Most forms of pollution, you know, they're disincentives. They have a price direct or indirect. And so they take those streams of pollution into account in their business planning. This pending legislation would do that for CO2. And it would give a long phase-in period, a lot longer than I would like, but if it's an 18-year phase-in period and the limits get lower each year, a coal-fired generating plant's got to be amortized over a 50-year period. The investor's looking at what's going to happen 18 years into a 50-year period. That will have an immediate effect. Immediately, it will spur interest in building these kinds of concentrating solar thermal plants, enhanced geothermal, photovoltaics, wind, and the rest.
John, let me also say this to Peter Harvey. When I go home tonight, I'll drive past El Dorado Valley. It's between Railroad Pass and Searchlight. Looks like a large area, but it is very small. 87% of the state of Nevada is owned by the federal government. The potential here is endless. And that's why Secretary Salazar came here a month ago and set aside 700,000 acres in the Southwest for solar only. El Dorado Valley is great. I'm glad we're doing some things there, but the potential is really remarkable. What we need are a couple things. We need this legislation passed. Part of the legislation that we need was mentioned by Kathy, and that is, what good does it do to produce a lot of energy if you have no place to take it? And that's what's happening all across America. Out on our oceans, that you can produce so much energy with windmills and with waves, but the problem is there's no place to take it because it's so difficult to get a power line built. The same in the deserts of the Southwest, the great wind corridors in the middle part of our country. We need a smart grid. What does that mean? It means a superhighway to take the power that is created to where it's needed.
Thank you. Kathy raised the issue of financing, and President Clinton focused his remarks in the renewable section on financing. Both the House passed bill and the Energy Committee bill create a green development and deployment authority, a so-called green bank. Boone, I know you've been in the market to try to get financing on renewable projects. That will leverage a lot of money, taking some federal dollars, but leveraging private sector money. We talked about in our report, we needed $500 billion of investment. That's mostly coming from the private sector. How are we going to get that done, and how much is financing a problem right now?
Well, let's talk about when. I'll remember next time. Talk about wind just a second. You know, it's tough to finance now, and it has an interesting part to it because, you know, I chirp about natural gas so much and that we should use this great resource in America, but natural gas actually is a margin for power generation, and wind is priced off the margin. So when natural gas is below $7, you can't price a wind project. It's very, very difficult to do. You can't get the financing. And so is that good or bad? Well, the cheaper natural gas is, if you're going to use it for transportation fuel, that's good. If it takes you out of the wind business temporarily, that's bad. So these things, you know, it's just markets that you're going to deal with. But you get the green bank in the climate bill, and that's where it is, that you put the green bank in there and then leverage off of that. But you've got to be realistic. And I'm in the wind business, and I'm sitting here trying to finance a big project, and I can see it but I can't touch it. You know what I mean? It's out of my reach right now. But I know I'll get there. I'm okay. One thing that's great, John, is I don't start receiving all those turbines until the first quarter of 2011. And geologists are very, very optimistic people because they drill so many dry holes. They have to be. But here, I'm going to get those turbines in the first quarter of 2011. I better have my deal financed by then because my garage isn't large enough to...
We have a lot, the government getting involved in a lot of important financing activities right now because of what happened in Wall Street last year. The Green Bank is going to be an important thing. The loans that the Department of Energy is working on now, the Treasury Department is providing grants in lieu of tax credits. That's going to be a huge boon to the renewable energy infrastructure development in the next couple of years. But at the end of the day, it's going to be policy that creates the safe haven for capital. If we have strong policies, if we have a strong cap on carbon, if we have a strong renewable portfolio standard, once we come out of the recovery, the money will follow. And I think Boone would agree with me.
I agree 100%.
The capital has to be safe. It will be safe with policy. We've never had that in this country before, and we need it now.
We have a question from Ray McCullis from Lenexa, Kansas, I probably pronounce his first name right because I'm half Greek, but I probably pronounced the name of the town wrong. But it's to Mr. Pickens. Can you ask Warren Buffett, Bill Gates, and other business leaders to join you in efforts to spur clean energy and energy security? So another organizing assignment for you, Boone.
Well, one of the first people I went to see, which was in, I believe it was June of last year, but I went to see Warren and knew him, and I said, Warren, the security issue is driving me crazy, and I said, I'm getting so damned old that I'm afraid what's going to happen is I'm going to have been given a mission, and I passed it up, and then I'm going to be too old to fulfill the mission. And he said, what are you talking about? And I said, well, let me show you. And I got up on he had a whiteboard. I'd been in his office before, and he has a big whiteboard, so you can get up there and write all over it. So I did, and he asked me questions about it and all. Well, know this, that Warren Buffett is very deep into transmission. I think it's Midcon's the name of his company, but he also is very big in wind energy too. So I was going to a guy with a lot of experience asking some questions about some subjects I didn't know all that much about. But I did scribble on the board, scribble. I got through and I said, we could really reduce dependency on foreign oil by actually removing natural gas from power generation and let it go to transportation fuel. And so I went through that, scribbled some stuff up there and all. And I said, what do you think? He said, let me think about it. He said, and I took the eraser and walked over to the board. He said, don't erase it. I don't want you to erase it. And that was on a Thursday. And the following Wednesday, he called me and he said, you're on the right track. You're on the right track. Now, Gates, I say hello, Bill, and shake hands with him, and that's all the conversation I've ever had with him. But Buffett and I have talked about this several times. And on the book, my book that came out last year, Buffett does, he is on the cover of the book commenting. He said, Boone knows what he's talking about on energy. So I've talked to him, and you're exactly right. But, I think that I never have anybody that says, Boone, what you're talking about is not a good idea. Nobody ever says that to me. And I don't know whether they're polite to an old guy or whether they agree with me, but I don't get any pushback. And I would give me 1 minute on this subject because I didn't finish that. And after I was through, old Terry, said there that I didn't get in to see Republicans. I only got in to see Senator Reed. That's not true. I always got in to see Republicans. They never did anything for me, was the thing. But I was, that was easy to get in. It wasn't easy to get anything done. But, when I went to Senator Reed with the idea and he sat there and listened to it, I've never had anybody in Washington respond like you did to me. When I got through that, you said, what you're saying, Boone? He said, I believe you. And he said, I think you're an honorable person, even though we've disagreed in politics from time to time. He said, I never thought you were anything other than an honest guy. And I said, that's one of the reasons I came to see you. I felt the same way about you. But we sat there and talked about something that was totally nonpartisan. It was two Americans talking about a problem for America. It had nothing to do with politics. And that's exactly the way we approached this, and that's the way we've carried it out. And it's...
Mr. Vice President, you deal with business leaders all the time. You sense any change of attitude? Is there real leadership now coming forward on this question?
Oh yes. You look at the group of large Fortune 500 companies that have come out in favor of the pending legislation. Jeff Immelt of GE had an op-ed co-authored with John Doerr in the Washington Post just last week. There are lots and lots of business leaders who are very excited and interested in investing, and they see the future coming, and they see it's a lower carbon future. So I think the business community is way ahead of most of the political community. If everybody was like Senator Harry Reid, then we would be already solving this thing. But you know, the fact is there are a lot of special interests. It's kind of a pejorative phrase to use, I guess, the way it's been used so much. But in our political system today, they really do have too much influence, way too much influence. And they have the power to block good things if they don't think it's in their interests. And I do believe that, even though it sounds like a large task, that in order to solve the climate crisis, we're also going to have to address our democracy crisis and get the people back in the driver's seat.